You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more. Today on our show, we're talking with Marjorie Lucebrink. She's known as MD Coverley in the writing that she does. Marjorie, thanks so much for being with me today.
Delightful to speak with you, Brainerd, and I'm glad to join this exceptional group.
Thank you. To begin with, normally I would talk about the work that you're doing now, but to put that in context and so the listeners can understand the kind of writing you do and perhaps how it began or one of the more seminal works, why don't we go back to the 80s when you began this, what would be called the first generation of electronic literature, hypertext novels. I don't want to say too much more, but can you talk about the beginning of that, when that first happened?
Yeah, you know, it was a very exciting time. A new medium comes along, and ever since computers became available, you know, artists and musicians and gamers and writers have been exploring the creative possibilities, you know, of what you'd call digital arts. And that would be work that you just start on the computer and work straight through. For example, a writer doesn't write it up first on paper. They start on the computer, and it's born digital. And my own computer practice began back in 1982 when I got my first IBM computer, and I was also working with randomized poetry in that, where the computer recombined words and sentences. But my real interest was in interactive narrative, and so...
Okay, but before you get into interactive narrative, how were you working with randomized ideas? That's still a programming, especially at that early stage, that was somewhat of a sophisticated thing to do as well.
Right. Well, yeah, very few people were doing that kind of thing. We're still doing randomized work. I mean, it's still part of electronic literature, but in those days, I was teaching at Orange Coast College, and I knew some people in the computer department, and I was very interested in what they were doing, and it seemed to me that my writing classes would at least be interested, if not learn a great deal, from seeing what happened if their poems were randomized. So we worked up a program to do that and had a unit on it. And we're very surprised to see which kinds of things looked very different if they got recombined.
So what does that exactly mean? When the poem is randomized, a poem that someone writes is fed into a computer and it comes out with the words all mixed up. I mean, it seems to have relationship almost to kind of concrete work as well. But is that what happens? It kind of goes in and then kind of comes out in this random order that can be read?
Yes. And some concrete poets moved into that kind of thing as well when they started doing computer work. The writer has no control over the computer per se, but the writer has control over the programming. So the program can instruct the machine to take every fifth word, for example, an n-gram, and simply spit that out and go over and over the poem and do this m-gram, which would be every fifth word of the poem until the entire poem is completed.
I see. Okay, so that was the beginning. I kept you on that, but then moving forward, that led into the...
So then I was actually more interested in what would happen in narrative writing, in novel writing and short stories, because that's what I was doing. And there were, you know, these kind of interesting questions that came up right away if you were going to try to write a novel and do it on the computer, because it wasn't going to be a print thing, and it wasn't going to be an opera, and it wasn't going to be a drama, and it was going to be something entirely different, and it would be digital-born fiction. So writers were asking themselves questions like, so how do you make a plot trajectory when in hypertext the reader could select any part of the story or any part of the chronology and go to it immediately? Maybe jumping over the murder. Who knows?
Right. So that's a very interesting question. That of course a lot of people understand now, but what we're talking about is, just to be clear, is links within the text.
Right.
Those hyperlinks that are often blue or another color, and you click on those links, and now we're used to that jumping us to another section. But in what you're talking about, part of the questions that writers were discussing is how are those used in a narrative structure? Is that correct?
How would they be used in a narrative structure where you didn't want someone to use the computer like they were doing, you know, going shopping or plotting their airline, but rather if something important happened, we didn't want them jumping to another page. So people like Michael Joyce had what they called guard fields, which meant that you had to read one lexia before it would let you go to another. But I didn't want to do that. I wanted to have a wide open landscape where the reader with two keystrokes could be anywhere in this landscape in any one of the time periods talking to any one of the narrators. So there were three narrators and five time periods, and it was a whole landscape of Southern California, and I wanted it all to be available right that minute to the reader. And so how is a chapter in that case, and what do you do for an ending, and what's the role of image and sound and architecture in relation to the text, and how does the interface design affect point of view, pacing, time frames, and so forth? All those questions were hard to solve, and in fact, I don't think we've actually solved them yet. That's one of the exciting things about the field.
And so when did you first publish a book? Because, of course, it means something different to publish a book as well this way. Maybe we can talk about the one that received so much attention, which was Queen Califia.
Califia. Yeah, I started Califia in 1995, and you would think, since I'd been working since 1980 or thereabouts, that it would be funny that I wouldn't start it till 1995, but the truth of the matter is that what I wanted to do wasn't possible until computers became robust enough to handle 256 colors, which isn't very much. Now we use millions and millions, and a little bit of sound and a little bit of, a more robust hypertext structure. So I started Califia in 1995. I received a grant, an NEH grant, to participate in Literatures in Transition at UCLA that was organized by Kate Hales, who was one of the leaders in hypertext literature and literatures in digital form. And then I also started publishing on the web. So I published a couple of pieces in the Orange Coast magazine. I talked them into getting a website in 1995. And I published The Virtual Mausoleum, which was a kind of website that was my mother's gravesite, except it was on the web with pictures of her best golf scores and her favorite jewelry and stuff, her favorite songs. And then another one was When the Going Gets Tough, the Tesco Cyber Shopping, all of which was kind of new at the time. And then at that time I started Califia. And that was published in 2000 as a CD-ROM by Eastgate Systems, and it's a computer-based kind of epic of stories, photos, graphics, letters, maps, music, animation. It has 800 screens, 2,400 images, and 30 soundtracks. It was at the time probably one of the most ambitious pieces out there.
And so how is that generated and stored? That sounds like it's kind of like making a film, really, like sort of an interactive film. There's so much media there. How did you build that and assemble that?
Yeah, Brainerd, that's such an interesting question, because most of the electronic literature writers and some of the artists, no matter how much variety they have in their skills, resort to some kind of collaboration. And, when you look at a movie, you see, screens and screens of credits. and we don't have anywhere near that. But I of course, I got musicians from California, including the Grateful Dead, to give me clips and soundtracks for the sound for Califia, and I had many people help me with the programming.
Fantastic. So it's a huge collaborative effort is really what happened.
Yeah, and even collaborative from the past, because I had six generations of Californians behind me, and they didn't leave me any money, but they left me a lot of pictures and newspaper clippings and, you know, ball invitations and stuff like that. So I used everything in the garage.
Well, which is wonderful, because it kind of that form, as you were building it there, was that seems like a structure that would be natural for it, a kind of researching clues, right? The reader is searching in a variety of ways for different kind of clues to a perceived puzzle. Was that the basic structure of that?
Yeah. I saw that as being something I could do because it was a new form. And that, you know, certainly the treasure map is a tried and true favorite thing of everyone, from children to grown-ups, but it hadn't been done on the web, and so or in electronic digital form. So I thought of this as kind of a combination treasure map and choose your own adventure, just because that was a fun way to think about the fact that people would traverse it, but not necessarily read all of it.
And then let's talk a little about what happened once it was published, so to speak. It was received very well, had great critical reviews, and I imagine began growing the conversation tremendously between other writers and yourself. Or maybe you can tell me a little bit about what it was like when it was first, being received.
Eastgate was already pretty well known among the people who were working in hypertext literature. There was already kind of a hypercard school, which were people who were building stories in hypercard, which was all text. That was an Apple program. And then there were people who were what they call the story space school, and they were using Eastgate's proprietary software, which was called Story Space, which was very, very interesting and fun to use, but not robust enough for what I wanted to do, because it couldn't really handle color images or sound or anything. But those people were all moving forward and working in different kinds of forms, and so they formed a very enthusiastic audience, and of course everyone was interested in all the new work that everyone was doing at that time, because it was new, and it was that kind of pioneering spirit of here we are going forward and finding something so fascinating and interesting. And it was interesting to research, it was interesting for scholars, it was interesting for critics. So that kind of formed around the group that Kate Hales had brought together at UCLA and the Brown group that were doing the Story Space Hypertext. And from there, we went to forming the Electronic Literature Organization, which was formed in 1999. And the last conference we had people from 27 countries.
Wow! So it grew huge. So in the few years as that was developing, let's talk a little bit about, before we come up to the present, some of the platforms that were being used and I suppose are now discarded. As an issue in this, because not only is the medium growing and tools being added and the power of computers increasing, mm-hmm. but also some of the platforms where these were shown can no longer be read from. Is that the case? And if so, how? And how do you deal with that?
Well, it's actually two of the kind of givens of electronic literature and the digital arts are, first of all, the issue of obsolescence. And second of all, the issue of how we learn to embrace the new forms that come out. So that, for example, right now, the things that will be going into the Electronic Literature Collection number 3 include virtual reality cave things and the documentation of that, and augmented reality works where the computer computer camera, you show something to the computer camera, and it pulls up a whole story after it looks at what you show to the camera, and then it does that in 3D. So there are all these new forms that are coming out. Yeah. And also, of course, we have all the new forms that are coming out for the new media. And those are all incorporated and coming into the electronic literature fold, I hope. We have a new novel, Pry, for three really important tablet pieces already that have come out. And then we have cell phone pieces and locative work where you use your GPS to solve mysteries and follow storylines. But as we look at those, we're also looking at the fact that when Apple discontinued HyperCard, it wouldn't give the source code so that nobody could recreate or make a virtual machine of all the HyperCard works that were out there. StorySpace works are still, for the most part, using StorySpace software, and some of them are still on little floppy disks, and which haven't been on computers for 10 or 15 years now. I used a program for Califia that was fabulous called Toolbook, but it's now been bought by 5 different companies and is a very expensive, specialized tool for retrieving data for building airplane wings and doing large-scale training. So it's
oh, my
it's
God.
Not.
So can Califia be read now? Is it?
Well,
is
it turns out, of course, it couldn't be read for about 4 or 5 years on the contemporary machines. But now they have a thing called virtual VMware, which will create a virtual machine, and then it will play something from, let's say, Windows XP or one of the older programs, and or Windows 7 now, I suppose. And so you can make a virtual. I happen to have saved my computers from way back save the system units, and then pretty soon I found a guru who could make virtual machineware. So now I can play everything. And I think we will be able to save the things that we have the machines to make a virtual machine of.
But I don't understand how that will happen. I mean, I understand how you have it and you could play it, but in the future, how will perhaps the average consumer download and read that book?
Well, it's gonna. I think that with cloud computing, it's really not too much of a problem if someone is a researcher if they would like to download the virtual machine and then play a work that they have. But Brainerd, you're right in the sense of a wide audience being able to discover a really important tradition of electronic literature from 1990, let's say, on. It won't happen.
And, I suppose in the last 5 years, so many things have changed. Your projects have continued to grow. And also, is there a connection with the gaming industry in this? I have a 14-year-old son. Yeah. He plays games on the PC as well as the others. He's enormously interested in great stories that are being told. And although it's, perhaps much more one-dimensional, these are also stories that are narratives that can be played out in a whole variety of ways depending on what kind of decisions you often make.
Right. Well, in fact, gaming has really always been a part of the electronic literature scene, whether it was interactive fiction where you answered and then went on and you were solving problems that way, or early games are being researched and looked at, including the early Mario Brothers games, by the gaming critical studies people who are a part of the electronic literature circles. And you have things like Myst, which are definitely literature, even though they're also games. And we have many electronic literature people are in gaming studies departments at universities across the country. And that is, in a sense, always kind of a go-to place when a gamer wants to make something that has more of a narrative or many more layers or more complexity. Then they look at these game studies and the stuff that's been published, and most of that's come out of the electronic literature cluster. So gaming, we have one of our pieces that was shown recently is called New Word Order, and it's a piece about Iraq and Basra, and it uses a single shooter mentality game position to shoot the words off of this screen and recreate the story.
So there are obviously all these, you know, gaming devices or iconography that you're using now as well.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
That's very interesting. And I was reading an article, I think it was early last year, and I can't remember all the references in it, but they were talking about that early Atari game, Zorro, I think, that was all
right.
Text-based, and how there were different arguments within the gaming community, and this is just last year, about what constitutes a game. And it seems like such a different issue maybe than what a kind of electronic literature organization might be talking about, or maybe not. But the issue is kind of if it's just text, it's not really a game. And of course, other people thought very much the opposite. Is that also, you know, an issue that the ELO, if I can say that, discusses and is involved with? Is it a book or is not a book? It's kind of redefining it, or is it a game or is not a game? They seem to be sort of fluid definitions, is what I'm trying to say.
Yes, that's definitely true. The fluidity is one of the things that makes the field so interesting, because in fact, it's been all the way along. The creations that are coming out of digital arts and culture are challenging the notions of barriers and boundaries. People are always crossing over. We have installations that are clearly pieces of literature. For one of them, for example, in some of the installations which are kinetic, a reader will stand in front of the screen and, by waving his or her arms, change the text on the screen and recreate a poem or a short story. So then we say, well, is that an installation? Is it installation art? Is it literature? And so forth. And these questions arise at almost every edge. You know, it's almost like a, you know, an octagon. Every single time we get to an edge, there's you know you think that's the only edge that you have to adjudicate, but they're all over the place.
It's exciting because it sounds to me unlike perhaps some writing in the past. Certainly, you know, writing novels, it was often a solitary act, whereas this type of writing seems like an enormously collaborative adventure, very much like filmmaking. Is that the case?
Well, I think it's not only collaborative, but it's social in kind of an important way. For example, some of the novels or stories that have been done are collaboratively interactive. For example, I did a piece called N is for Nottingham for a TRACE conference in the UK, and we did a Mystery of Nottingham online drama online for the 3 months before the conference, in which everyone was seeking down clues and doing interactive, you know, sharing information and so forth. And then when we got to the conference, we actually staged a live play that recapitulated the online experience.
Huh, I love that. We have some
of our most important and well-known people have almost as most of their practice being on the web every day and doing code writing or networking or blogging. So these are all part of the literature effort, I think.
That makes sense. Yeah, these are all the tools that are inherent in the medium. And mm-hmm. in closing, I'd like to talk a little bit about one of your recent projects. We talked about it a little bit off the record. Is it a poem you're working on now that relates to some of what we're talking about?
I'm so glad you asked, because of course this brings up so many of the issues that we've been talking about and mirrors them. I'm doing a collaborative piece right now with a woman named Stephanie Strickland, who is a poet. I'm a fiction writer. We bring kind of different sensibilities to our work, but we've collaborated on several pieces. We decided that we wanted to do a piece in a software that had some stability, since many of the softwares are no longer supported by their makers or the people or the companies that bought them. And so we picked PowerPoint, which is ubiquitous, and we decided to make a PowerPoint poem. And we also wanted to take a subject matter that was not so popular, and so we chose the nighttime and sleeping patterns in people who are growing older. And it references back to the Middle Ages, when people used to get up in the middle of the night and make love or go steal chickens or talk to their friends or whatever, and then they'd go back to sleep, and then they'd wake up again, and then they'd go back to sleep again. And you can see that in a lot of medieval journals and diaries and so forth, that the ancient people without artificial light didn't sleep straight through the night. So we have done a poem that references back to that and goes through the hours of the night and has sound and poetry and, of course, image and interaction.
I love that. And so how will that be presented? I mean, PowerPoint does sound like that's really interesting, a robust platform, right? It's something I never would have thought that way, but of course it is. It's been around forever, and I imagine, you know, iterations of it will be for a long time. So as you work together, how, I guess, that will be presented, that can't actually be read, that has to be presented in a kind of lecture format?
Yeah, it's first thing that was interesting was that we chose it because it was ubiquitous, and we thought it would maybe never go away. We hoped so. But it turned out that it wasn't so easy to actually put it up on the web, because you couldn't actually put a PowerPoint piece up on your website, and someone could download it, but in order to play it, they needed to have PowerPoint on their machine. And PowerPoint has got several iterations, and we did ours in PowerPoint 13, which is different from PowerPoint 10. So that turned out to be more problematic than we thought it would be. We're going to be displaying it, showing it at the exhibit at ELO and the Digital Summer Humanities Institute in Victoria, Canada in June. So we made an MP4 movie of it so that it could run in a gallery.
Oh, that makes sense. And so the ELO seems very, very active. Is that an online resource, or if listeners were interested, could they get involved more or learn more from the ELO?
Absolutely. Anyone who has an interest in electronic literature at all, from readers to critics to teachers, all invited. We have a website at eliterature.org that I hope we're going to be redoing soon. That seems to be the thing that we never have enough money for.
Well, and something that I would imagine would have to be endlessly redone. I mean, it's so fascinating that an archive in this sense has a very different meaning and much more complex than any other medium.
Yes. Well, I suppose if you were looking at the beginning of film and several different kinds of film and so forth, that might have resembled it in terms of a medium and the complexity of keeping up with the technology. But as everyone is aware, nothing matches the speed of electronic communication technology. So we have a website. We have conferences every year. On our website, we have a gallery where you can look at electronic literature, and links to our collectives where you can see the work that's been done, and find more about electronic literature.
Marjorie, thanks so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to talk to you, and I want to thank you so much for the service you're doing. It's really a great resource for the arts community and for all of us.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.